Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. Okay, so apologies on the low volume in this intro. I'm away on a bit of a working holiday, as mentioned last time. So coming at you from my PC's microphone this time around. This episode's kind of a JREP session. It's really only Emil and myself, and we had a nice, long, casual riff on the topic of seasonality in Japan's property market. What are the dead times of the year? What are the busiest ones? And business seasonality as well, financial quarters and quotas, realtor priorities, depending on each. And then common sales practices and so forth. And then we dove deeper into Japanese realtors and their habits, how they deal with inquiries from foreigners, when they take time off. We then segued into our own business practices. When do we take time off and what form does that time off then take? Time management for business owners, working through holidays, scheduling viewings on off times, how the pace is different for scheduling these kinds of things here in Japan as opposed to elsewhere. And we also discussed portfolio structuring a bit, who should be buying what types of properties, how that might depend on previous existing investment portfolios and life circumstances, age and so forth. And we even busted some myths and discussed some preconceived opinions and assumptions about the market here as far as property prices are concerned. And then lastly, we chatted a bit about renovations and repairs as opposed to complete rebuilds. When exactly should a complete teardown and rebuild be considered? So really, really diverse, good chat. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Cool. Japan Real Estate Experts Panel in a truncated format.
That's it. Just the two guys.
Been a while.
We're missing
I
the
just
lady.
Came back from Australia. Did you go anywhere?
I was in Australia, but I think I've already come back and we've had a podcast since then. I'm going back in a few weeks anyhow, in September. In like two more weeks, I'm going back to Australia for 2 weeks.
How was the summer holiday for you? I've noticed in our franchise business where we're using, we got shops and stuff, it's gone down significantly. People just don't go out of the house that much during the summer. But work-wise on real estate, I don't think it's affected us much. How about you?
Obon is a very quiet period. And it's quiet because, one, lots of people are on holiday, but also lots of agents are closed. So if we want to do a viewing for a client, the seller's side is not operating for that whole week, for the Obon period. So yeah, it does get a bit quiet. Our office is still running as always. We always have staff in there 7 days, but a lot of the other agents will be closed, be them big or small.
Oh, and your clients are almost always going to be domestic clients, right? So they're off for Obon too, which is not the case with us. Our customers, I always have to explain, there's nobody here. I can't talk to anyone for 10 days.
Yeah, so my clients, it's both, right? So some people are gone, but a lot of other people are there. Their office is closed, so they're free to go do viewings. So it kind of works both ways. The national holidays is like people are, or long weekends, sometimes clients are gone, but other clients are like, this is a great opportunity for me to go and view houses.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of both, but the issue is more so the other party, the seller's side is closed. So there's not much we can do with a lot of those houses. If it's a brand new house or a developer or a renovated property, so a renovation company that's flipping it, they basically leave the key box on the front door or nearby, and so we can access it any time.
So you have been working during a bond, have you?
Yes, I have been.
Okay. Gotcha.
The nature of my work, because I've got my family in Australia and I go sort of holidays there and whatnot, I work all the time. Sometimes I'm here, sometimes I'm overseas. And just because of this particular year's arrangement when the family's in Australia. But yeah, I work all the time, and I take time off accordingly if I've got to take the kids to swimming lessons or sports
Yeah,
events.
very similar here. Basically 24/7 switched on, but you got the flexibility to decide when you want to switch off for a few hours, right?
Correct, correct.
Yeah. I
So
think
it's
that's probably most business owners that I know. But that's actually a really good topic. I think the holiday periods in Japan are, aside from the Christmas and New Year's holiday, are a bit different to the rest of the world, right?
Definitely different to Australia. And I'm familiar quite now. Look, most of my clients are families with young children and kids in primary school, elementary school. So even like myself, the school holidays are kind of now where our holidays are aligned. If we want to travel as a family, it's going to be largely the school holiday period.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, so the peak season. I remember previously when, before kids, anytime I'd want to travel overseas, I think, okay, why is it all, why are the prices all of a sudden so expensive for tickets and whatnot? It's purely school holidays. They are the number one decider. So you know what the school holidays are, and you work around those. But right now, because we've got three children all in elementary school now, that's what we have to balance for. But they are different to the Australian school holidays. So fortunately, now when I go visit Australia to see the family, it's during Australian school holidays, which do not match up with the Japanese ones. So I'm getting good value flights in and out of
Yeah,
Australia.
except that there's what I've noticed now when we came there in August is that there is just nobody for the kid to play with, right? Because they're all in school all the time.
Yeah. Definitely, the August summer, the summer holidays, all
Yeah.
the cousins and whatnot
Yeah,
are in
business
school.
as usual in Australia. And I find that I need to explain to our customers every year. So we got Golden Week, which is, a week that kind of stretches a bit into 10 days, and then a bond, which is about the same. And then the end of year, which is kind of like 2, 2.5 weeks. And it's not just that period itself, because our customers, for example, are expecting, okay, Monday, the holiday's over, everyone's back in the office, back in business. No, there's a backlog of about a week before the holiday where everyone was rushing to finish just the urgent stuff and left stuff off. And then all of the emails accrued during the holiday from people who are not on holiday, especially if they're overseas. So it's more like, I'm probably thinking 3 week kind of lag in performance with every 1 week holiday, right?
Yeah, well, what you're saying is right. There is that. Like we said, with the nature of my business, the main thing we want to do is schedule viewings, right? So we just want to schedule it and go view the properties. And as long as the agents are working, like their office is not closed, then we are able to do that. And most of the time, that's the weekend. What we have common with the real estate industry, the eight real estate agents, Tuesday, Wednesday are the agents industry holidays weekend, Tuesday and Wednesday, because we
Oh,
work on the
Tuesday, really? We haven't experienced that much. Tuesdays they're off too. Oh yeah, once in a while I get that, yeah.
Wednesday, definitely. Tuesday, it depends on the agency, right? But I guess some
If
of
they
them
work Sunday, they probably take the Tuesday off as well. And if they just work the Saturday, they'll get the Wednesday, right?
actually no, that's not the case. So a lot of smaller offices we'll just have Wednesdays off. And then depends on how many agents they have. The agents can take different sort of days off here and there. And maybe because you often work with like more regional areas, your experience is, I'm assuming, more so with some smaller agencies here and there.
Correct. Yes, in most
Yeah.
cases.
In Tokyo, it's like, what is it? Tokyo Livable, these huge real estate agencies, right, with branches everywhere. And these big agencies have fixed Tuesday, Wednesday off, closed, right? There's just no one answers the phone. You just get a message. So with lots of viewings that we want to do, you just, oh, there's even just emailing or any kind of response, phone calls, nothing happens on Tuesdays, Wednesdays. The agents don't answer their calls. Even the sales guys, just you're not getting the phone picked up on a Tuesday or Wednesday. So that delays, so nothing happens in that period as well. So our industry, like with the agents, it's kind of, you know, in Tokyo at least, it differs. You have those gaps as well in terms of delay. But outside of that, if we want to do a viewing, weekends are the most common because when the agents are working, and usually that's when the seller is in the house and able to unlock the door for the agent.
That's when the buyer is generally available because they work during the week too, right?
Correct. But sometimes I have buyers that are, oh, we're free, you know, tomorrow. Like a lot of people that either work from home or whatnot, just say, oh, look, Thursday afternoon, I'm free. Can we view it Thursday, 1 o'clock? But the seller is actually at work or they're working. Mm-hmm. So they're not able to open the door for the agent. So quite often it's weekends only is when we do viewings. But as long as the agent is open, we can kind of work around and schedule.
Yeah. And are you noticing any general business seasonality? Like, you know, for example, for renters, for people, tenants moving in and out of properties, it's usually around the April, the end of the academic year, and the company's reshuffling of staffing and onboarding of new staffers. Any other periods during the year where you're noticing an increase or decrease in sales?
Yeah, so what you mentioned is correct, but also every quarter.
Oh, when they want to get stuff off the books, right?
Yeah, every quarter is when. So for me, I don't really mind. It's whenever an individual is looking for a property. But often, again, I deal mostly with family homes. People have children. They want to get it done between like January and April, before the start of the new school year, because they want their kid to be in the school from April.
At the new school, yeah.
At the new school. They don't want to change mid-year or after 2 months or 3 months. Mm-hmm. So my clientele tend to, you know,
more supply on the market, you think, during those dates?
There's a lot more transactions happening.
Yeah.
But then also you have each quarter. So that's a common fiscal year end, March and April. So you have that as well with companies wanting to do their close, but every quarter after that as well, a lot of the sales agents' incentive, they have quarterly targets. So they're trying to be really pushy on sales on both their buyers and their sellers to meet their quarter targets. So that's where you have also the seller side agents as well, because I almost always just represent the buyer. The seller side are also very keen to get deals done, right? Yeah. To meet their quota. So what they do is they tend to be a little bit pushy on the sale, on their clients, on the homeowners. Look, take this deal, take this offer. Maybe we need to reduce the price, etc., to try to stimulate it. They didn't care before, but now they've got to meet their quarterly target. So they get a little bit pushy on their side.
What do you mean before? Were they not compensated on sales before?
But they have a quarterly target, right?
Oh, so you mean before, during that quarter, up to that point?
Gotcha. Yeah, during that quarter. Okay. So they're compensated on the sale, but at the same time, they also have there's like team, each companies are different, but often there's like a team
goal. Yeah.
Goal, right? The whole team needs to achieve a certain total amount for them all to receive kind of certain levels of bonus. It's not each individual gets a percentage of their commission only. There's team dynamics. So the entire team want to start closing some deals if they haven't met their quota. Alternatively, if they have met their quota, they're not pushy at all. You know, why close this in March?
Might as well put that sale for next quarter.
Yeah, put that in April. Let's reschedule April 1st, yeah.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
I can't help but wonder how... Is that of value to the buyers and sellers?
No, not at all.
Right.
So I'm the way I work, I'm structured, I don't have a quarterly target.
Yeah.
I can see, look, traditional sales, that's how they need to work, right? Like you need to have goals and targets. And that's why if a client, and I tell my clients, look, you can walk into an open house if you like, but you're going to be hounded and bombarded by the salespeople. And often, like when you go to an open house or just walk in or contact an agent, you have to fill out all your information, all your form, exactly the same thing I request, you know, your name, your address, your employment, income, all that sort of stuff to understand your situation and what kind of property that you're looking for. But those sales guys know if you just walked in or if you just called them from an online listing, what's going to happen is you may disappear after this interaction. So if they don't close you, they've lost you. So you saw this property last week. Okay, what do you think? Do you want to buy it? And they'll bombard you with other stuff, or they'll try to keep you there because they know there's no relationship. There's no reason for you as the buyer to stay engaged with this particular agent. Mm. Right? Or you're a random inquiry and you'll disappear. So they have to try to keep you and push you and close the deal, even if you don't love the house, they'll try to do it. Let's get the papers. Let's get, they'll ask you to fill out the forms and let's do a trial loan. Let's submit to the bank, this and that, to get you as far along the process as possible into their system. I don't have to do that because lots of clients come to me because I offer some value add. One, I provide the information in English and, I understand the financing dynamics for foreigners and also happy to share sort of my experience with a young family, what requirements we have for the house. And so I'm in no rush. And a lot of my clientele is word of mouth. Mm. So the moment I'm pushy or forceful and try to get people to buy a property that's not what they want, then I'm not going to get that word of mouth. I'm going to lose that relationship and all of their potential friends and clients. And lots of, families or people with kids have other friends with kids. All their friends are foreign families with kids who are also probably professionals, employed full-time, and who are quite stable and looking to buy their own place. So it's in my best interest to just really help the person buy and find the house that they love, that's really suitable for them. Because I don't fear that they are just going to go and contact a different agent right away.
Plus, it's the right thing to do, to be fair.
And it's the right thing, yeah. So for me, actually, I think long-term, there's more value I get in terms of even just raw commission and raw sales through not being pushy versus, and that's because of the nature of my business and the way my clientele work. But I can definitely see how ordinary Japanese salespeople, even if one Japanese sales agent does a great job for a foreigner, that foreign person is not going to say, hey, I'm going to recommend you to this guy at, Tanaka-san at Mitsui Fudosan. it's just not going to happen. Right. So I've got a lot more invested of interest in my clients have to be really happy because my niche is so, you know, it's a small community.
Niche. Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I actually find myself convincing people to not buy a particular property a lot more than I convince them to buy it.
Correct. Oh, yeah. I tell people how crap properties are more often than I say this is a good one.
Yeah. And recently we've run into another problem here, which recently so we've been at it for about 12 years. When we started, Google Translate was not a big thing just yet, or, you know, built-in browser translations were not a big thing. And people were completely lost when they were looking for Japanese properties. These days, because it's a lot more feasible to actually understand what's happening in a listing online on your own, they actually do regularly try to contact the Japanese realtors. And more and more of the Japanese realtors, whether because, again, of translation apps or whatever other reason, we can discuss that, but they tend to be a bit more open to communicating with foreigners too, at least until the point where they're actually recognizing that, oh, this is becoming too complicated for my English skills and whatnot, which is when people tend to find us. But whereas in the past, they found us at the beginning of the process and we could handle the relationship with whatever agent we chose, now they're arriving to us with a correspondence email of about, you know, 3 months worth of mistaken translations in English and Japanese. And here is everything that we've already agreed with the agent. And now can you just take me over the finish line? And for us, it's a matter of, hang on, can we just review this correspondence to make sure that everything you think you've agreed with the agent, both parties are actually on the same page? And very, very often, I'd say most of the time, they're not.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And a lot of that as well is because of just, especially with first-time buyers, their cultural or their, sorry, no, don't say cultural, their traditional understanding of how real estate work in their home country.
Yeah.
Right? They, you know, don't understand all the concepts that, you know, the way it's structured, the way the process, the transaction happens is different to, you know, Australia, for example, than it is in Japan. So part of that misunderstanding is you have certain, you know, predefined ideas of how the process will go.
When I say settlement and you say settlement, we're not actually talking about the same thing.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Or deposit, the way it works. The contract and the different stages of everything. And then even just titles, title transfer. Okay. And like in Americans often, oh, what about title insurance? Or, you know,
escrow.
Yeah. Or escrow. Yeah. It's like, well, no, we don't, you know, that's not a common.
Not a thing here.
not really a thing, right? I think there is an escrow service and they charge what, 3%?
Yeah, they're insane. They started, I think, in the last 5 or 6 years. I don't know anyone that used them just because of those prices. It's like paying another agent on the entire transaction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, 3% of the total purchase price that you put into escrow for protection. Like, okay, a bit tricky, but that's fine. We actually had just to sort of pivot a little bit, but kind of in the same realm. We had a previous client who bought a house with us, is just bought an investment property, looked at an entire building. They were looking in Tokyo and we were working for, you know, looking for property in Tokyo, but the yields weren't so great. So he's like, look, you know, I want good cash flow property, not a, you know, like a long-term hold. I want cash flow right now. So we found a property in Saitama. It's a building, maybe about, was it like 15 years old or so? 4 apartments, so just 2 downstairs, 2 upstairs, nothing huge. But it gets a 7%, 7.3% gross yield. Mm. He owns the entire building. And we're able to get that financed at 70%.
That's 70% fantastic. Financing.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that just happened recently. I'm a big fan. People often ask, I get lots of calls, should they go for the high yield, like in sort of prefectures outside of Tokyo, similar to what you commonly do? Or what's the point in investing in a property in Tokyo that's only going to get 3.5% gross yield, right? Which is like, you know, 2.8% net depending. What's your response to that? What should they go for? Maybe less yield, newer building, or older building with a higher yield? What's your...
We usually start the conversation, and even if they don't actually ask that particular question, we initiate the conversation on, well, what does the rest of your investment portfolio as a family, as an individual, what does it look like? What do you have? Do you have other real estate? Are you in stock markets, blue chip, high risk, startups, cash flow properties, short-term stay? I'm trying to analyze if the vast majority of their portfolio, for example, is dividend or cash flow based, then, you know, maybe it does make sense to have something a bit more speculative that might gain in value. It gives you diversity and options to gain option to gain the profit in different ways. On the other hand, if everything is safe and stable, then yeah, let's go for higher cash flow. If everything else in your portfolio is yielding 3%, you know, let's complement that with something that's generating 5 or 6 or 6.5, whatever the case may be. So it very much depends on whether or not they have any other investment. If that's their first ever investment, I definitely go for a Tokyo, Fukuoka, Osaka, nice, safe and stable. And then once you've established a safe and stable baseline, then yes, you can get adventurous on the outskirts of your portfolio, right?
Okay. Yeah, interesting, interesting. So discussion I had with one of the guys at work, and sort of, well, how we kind of look at it is, like, again, my personal thought on it is, if you are sort of closer, like if you're a little bit older and closer to maybe looking at something to keep funding you into retirement, then all right, at that stage, you may be looking at something higher cash flow, right? You're not, when you're younger, you're trying to build your net wealth. Or in my case, at least, you know, I'm trying to build my net wealth. I don't need cash flow. I have cash flow. I have cash through my employment. So I don't need additional cash flow to supplement my living, my lifestyle, right? I want to just grow my net wealth. And I feel the growth of net wealth, that happens by maybe something like a not such an old building, something that is maybe has more potential to grow, to appreciate in value whilst not, while keeping. So even if it's, there's a correlation between the yield and the capital growth. If you expect more capital growth, then, and a more attractive investment in terms of long-term value, then you need to take a lower yield for it, right? So that's, okay, that's kind of what I prefer at this stage. I don't need the cash flow. So I'm all right with a low yielding property, but something that's central, not too old, and will have value, like, you know, hopefully more value in several years' time.
Or at least retain its value better, yeah.
Yeah, but even then, like, I guess the past, you know, 2 decades in Tokyo and, you know, the other cities you mentioned, you know, Fukuoka, Osaka, et cetera, they've been growing significantly, yep, value, right? Populations in these areas are kind of on the increase. So that's what I feel, is if you're a bit younger, you're trying to grow it, maybe focus on good quality property rather than a high yield. And then as you get, you know, as if you're a bit further on and you think, look, I need something, even if it's an older building, even if I'm not going to be able to resell it in 30 years' time, I need good cash flow for that period to fund me.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku, or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
And also sort of in terms of inheritance, you think, okay, well, how much of it do I need a great property that's going to be good inheritance versus something that I just need to, for me to provide cash?
And I'm going to resell anyway within 10 years, right?
Right. But again, that resale is also another depreciation or tax sort of strategy, right? Like that fits into your whole, you know, portfolio.
Yeah, I think it's very individual. We really try not to make, you know, general rule of thumb recommendations on this kind of thing, because I think everyone, like you said, everyone's goals and everyone's existing investments and everyone's financial situation. Like you said, do people need money in the bank every month, or are they okay sitting on it for a few years for potential bigger growth down the track? Very much case by case, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So another interesting, I guess a lot of my clients that are looking to buy, again, it's like kind of $500,000 up, or, you know, $300,000, $400,000.
You don't do the investments in your company, by the way. It's other people, right?
What do you mean?
Investment property. You mainly, your family homes, basically, right?
Family homes, yeah. But some of my clients also look, we want to buy an investment property. So that's like the owner change properties,
yep.
Right?
And tenanted properties that just change ownership, yeah.
Tenant properties, yeah. But these are still, you know, 1, 2, 3 LDK properties in Tokyo, right, that are owner change. So we'll still do them and we take over property management, but they're, you know, usually 300,000 US and up, right? So that's what, like, I mean, it's easy enough for me to do the search and find those properties. But that's not my main focus. So if someone inquires, you know, yep, I can pull up, I can do the search and I can do it. And pretty much I work with foreign clients, but if I get someone who's looking, look, they have like, they're looking for these really high yielding ones outside in different areas. That's when I'll say, look, contact Ziv.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah. That's your area. But in Tokyo for these kind of, you know, larger budget places, then yeah, definitely we can do it.
So here's a question. Do you find that people that contact you, and I'm thinking especially the ones maybe who haven't lived in Japan for a long time or are not that familiar with market basics here, do you find that people contact you and want to buy a family home and part of their assumption or part of their strategy is that the property will definitely gain in value as it would overseas? Do you confirm that to them? Do you discuss that with them? Do you say that it's a definite, it's not a definite, it's likely, it's not likely? What do you say? Because it is a bit different than in other countries. Yeah, the last 20 years have been good, but who knows, right?
Yeah, but one that can be said with every country. Right,
you know, I think so too, but people think, yeah, that every 7 years it keeps going up.
Yeah, well, we're you know, Australians have that expectation, but actually most, it's kind of the opposite. Most clients that come to purchase, or their first question is, what's the point, like what's the value, if what's the point rather of me investing if it's going to be worth nothing in 20 or 30 years.
Oh, I keep hearing that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've actually done there some research and they've come to a conclusion that real estate in Japan is worth nothing, depreciates to zero after 20 to 40 years.
Yeah.
And so I say, well, that's actually not the case.
No, not at all.
In fact, it's been appreciating historically. My kind of perspective on it is, even houses in Australia, if you have two properties side by side, same lot of land, same house, same design, same everything, One, it's basically the same house. One is 50 years old, one is brand new. Which one will be worth more?
Very clearly the new one
The
in
new one.
every country, in any country.
So, yeah, so to say the old one like hasn't lost value is wrong. It's basically like I think one like it's the land that appreciates. The building, the structure will depreciate. This is kind of in any country. That's why
Yes.
you see sometimes some shots like in the newspaper. This is what $2 million buys you in Sydney. And it's like this old, like it's literally a shed
Yeah.
falling apart. And you go, well, why? Because it's beachfront. So no one's paying $2 million for that house. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
One dynamic that is different though is in Australia at least, no one cares about the age of the building. If you have that clear contrast, new versus used, and it's the same thing side by side, yeah, of course the new one will be worth more than the existing one. But when you're looking at just the market in general, no one really cares about the age because often when if you renovate it and restore a building, that's good enough,
Yep.
right? It's on par with a new one, well, close enough to it. Whereas in Japan, they care about the age of the building. It's one of the same way as like mileage with a car. When you buy a car, the mileage and the age of the vehicle are significant factors. Same in Japan. Even if you renovate the house, it's still a 30-year-old house. And people are going to say, oh, it's the same as new. No, it's 30 years old. The age is a significant dynamic in the value of the building. So I would say rather, you're probably better off in Tokyo at least. Instead of spending 20 million yen on a full renovation of a 30-year-old house, spend 25, 30 million on rebuilding it to a new house.
Yeah,
Because
very
that
true.
value will stay there, whereas the 20 million you spent in renovation is not going to be there in a few years' time.
Yeah, but barring extreme cases, you know, a very well-built traditional home and you want to retain the original feel of it because that is actually what is the value, that's the main value of the property, is the fact that it was built 200 years ago, whatever the case may be, right?
Yeah, actually, so I just had a Zoom call with someone last night who they bought a 100-year-old building in Kyoto, and they're going to spend about like they said they want to rent like when they emailed me first, oh, I've got a 100-year-old property in Kyoto and I want to restore it. I'm like, oh, okay, like the land is big, and I said, okay, depending on the building. If it's just a really old shack, then it's not worth restoring. But when I saw the photos and the link, it's actually really one of those like really nice ones with the wood beams as you'd think of a 100-year-old one. So they're going
Yeah.
to spend like, you know, 800,000, like 80 million yen on the restoration. And
Mm.
yes, something like that, that's a traditional house. I'm talking more like a 40-year-old
Yeah,
stand cookie cutter, post
post-World
war
War
cookie
II
cutter house. Yeah.
1970s kind of shacks, yeah.
No insulation, no foundation, no fireproofing, nothing like that. Yeah, it's very, very different. But yeah, it is case by case. But the prices have been going up, especially with mansions, right? People are like, oh, what if I buy a mansion now for 80 million in Tokyo? In 20 years' time, I try to sell it, it's worth nothing. Like,
No.
well, you're buying it now at 80 million. Guess what? 20 years ago, when it was built, it was 50 million.
Yeah.
Right, so where's the depreciation in that regard? So I think people have certain misconceptions, and that misconception, the big one, is that real estate in Japan is worth nothing. Once you buy it, you're going to lose all your value.
Yeah, and also there's different pricing if the property is definitely clearly an investment property, meaning the owner is never going to live in it from the get-go. So it's nobody would buy a studio room that's, you know, studio apartment 30 years old and go live in it. If they have the money to purchase it, they're obviously living somewhere better. And those investment, clearly investment-only properties, they're not even priced with anything specifically related to, at least not as related to market fundamentals, more a case of how much they're actually yielding, right?
That's a really good point that you make, and we actually have this discussion a lot. Often buildings, with investment properties inside them, they're priced at a certain yield. So, and I think I've discussed this example before. I saw a building in Shibuya that was like that. And there were two apartments. One was on the seventh floor, and the rent was 200. I think it, that building, most of the apartments were priced at about a 4.5 or 4.6% rental yield. So the value of the property is priced depending on what's the rent. So the seventh floor apartment was getting 250,000 yen a month. So that was priced at 65 million yen. Three stories above it, identical apartment, as in exactly the same location, same size, just higher up with a better view, was rented at 195,000 yen a month. And that 55,000 yen difference, still at 4.6% yield, it was 55 million yen or 56 right. million. So it was like 10 million yen difference in price, 20% difference.
The price has to match the yield. Otherwise, an investor just doesn't buy it.
Yeah. And a big part of that, the idea and the thinking is, well, you know what? I'll buy the cheap one and then I'll kick the tenant out and jack up the rents.
Yeah.
And here is where in Japan, that process comes crumbling down.
Yeah.
Because you cannot kick out the tenants. Typical Japanese leases are almost perpetual. 2-year renewable lease, you cannot deny the renewal. If the tenant wants to stay there, they can stay there.
Legally. Generally speaking, Japanese tenants, I guess it could be different because we're dealing a lot with the cash cows, which means the tenants are, I mean, they're smaller, they're older, the tenants tend to be of a lower income profile.
Yeah.
So they are probably less aware of legislation and what tenant rights are. And then if you do ask them to move out, they will usually move out. Whereas people with higher salaries who are renting more expensive properties, like the ones you're describing, they're probably a bit more aware of what they can and cannot do legally, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're paying 200, 300,000 yen a month rent, you're like, yeah, no, I'm not going to. What do you mean? This guy wants me to move? No, I'm not going to move. they're a bit more clued in. It's not a single university student or a factory worker. They're more business professionals. So they know. And also, I feel probably before the seller is, like, the owner is aware of the situation, right? Or their agent is going to be aware of the situation. So perhaps the first thing they've said already is, look, will this guy leave? I feel that they would likely ask first. If they can get 10 million yen, $100,000 extra out of the deal, say, hey, can we give you 1 million yen to leave the apartment?
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARKReform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
The current tenant. So
That is something that you can, and we have done this in the past. If you're, for example, purchasing a property in the purpose of using it for your own personal use, but it currently has a tenant in there, it is possible to ask the seller to have a conversation and sign a memorandum with the tenant saying that they are willing to move out in, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, whatever the timeline is, as a condition of the sale. And the buyer gets that, and then everything's good.
Oh, yeah, I think that can happen. But in this case, we're saying, look, let's buy the cheaper apartment. Right. And it's 10 million yen cheaper because the rent is cheap. So to say, look, we want to buy it at this discounted price based on the discounted rent, but we want the condition that you kick him out or that he leaves. It's like, well, if they're going to get him to leave, then they can find a new tenant at the revival.
And they can price the property higher.
And they can price it themselves. It's like, well, they're providing it to you with the condition that you can right away increase the rents, essentially. So I feel with Tokyo Properties, the current owner would have already tried that to have that discussion with the existing tenant for the most part to try to get the higher value out of the property. But I think this is quite rare as well. It's rental prices are very much linear in terms of square meterage and very clear based on the on what the building in the area, right?
That's
Tokyo.
actually, I haven't actually thought of that, but just this discussion that we just had just made me realize something. In Japan, me as a landlord or a representative of landlords, I actually feel that lower income tenants in many aspects are easier to deal with. Whereas if I was to try and apply that in the States, I think I'd be in for a lot of trouble, for example, right? Because the lower income the tenant is, the more trouble you're going to have. Whereas here, I'm feeling like maybe not the very lowest income levels, but a moderate income or let's say entry level salaryman type tenant is probably going to be a lot less of a hassle than somebody who's living in a nicer apartment, has a higher salary, and is expecting things to be a lot nicer, right?
I don't. I feel that is not actually the case because when a tenant comes in Tokyo at least, when they come in, it's always new wallpaper, everything gets cleaned fully and professionally, and the house is really, really good. If something breaks, if there's the aircon or the tap breaks or whatever, then we just re it, the owner will just repair it. Okay, and that's kind of it. So what are they complaining about? We don't really get lots of complaints unless it's damage to the property.
Well, there's more, for one, there's more stuff to maintain in a nicer property. So that, I mean, that's a purely financial calculation. But I mean, topics like what we've just discussed, if you're considering raising the rent or you're considering asking them to move out, or for example, we bought an owner change property on behalf of a customer. And what we normally do, if the tenant doesn't have a guarantee company or rent insurance, as we like to call it, then we would ask the new tenant to sign up for it. And, you know, obviously the landlord, the buyer would pay the price of signing up for the contract. We're not changing the terms of the lease and asking the tenant to pay for that, but we are asking them to sign up. We did have one case. We had a tenant who was rather affluent. The property was, you know, of a nicer quality than what normally our customers go for. And he said, well, no, I'm a doctor. I've got a good salary. I've never had any payment issues. What, why are you asking? No, I refuse, right? Whereas that's never been the case with a lower income tenant. They just go out, they say hi, and they, you know, they sign the documents and they get it done.
Yep. Well, we have that a lot with the corporate leases. You
Okay.
know, if someone works for a large corporation and they're going to get a their company and it's a listed company and it's a corporate lease, they're like, why should Sony's going to pay their rent. They're not going to default on paying their rent. Like to ask us, we're not going to like we just don't expect us to sign a guarantee company, pay an extra month fee, and that is fine, to be honest. I feel like with these with the higher rent properties, it's just a better quality tenant. One, they if it's a corporate lease, then yeah, we can sort of not do the guarantee. But almost for any regular lease, to be honest, we'll get a guarantor, even if the person is a doctor or whatever it may be. Then we'll get the guarantee thing is quite standard now, but it's kind of the if there's a complaint, it's like, well, some damage to whatever of the fittings or fixtures. The cost to rent ratio is quite low. Like they're paying 300,000 yen a month, right? You can do significant repairs for 1 week worth of, like a shower head broke, that's 20,000 yen. Maybe they dropped it and it cracked the damage. Okay, it needs to replace. It's hard to say whose fault it was because you don't know. It's just faulty. Okay, well, it's 200 yen. Okay, send the tradie out to go and get it done. It's done and everything is fine. I feel Japanese don't complain so much, and they complain only like air conditioner is probably one of the big ones, right? Air conditioner or dishwasher stops working. So if that sort of happens, then or the now the air conditioners they're leaky, right? So if that happens, yeah, you've got to send someone out to go do it. But I just find there's not a lot of complaints, but also tenants will pay, and they stay sort of long term, and they don't trash the property. It's well taken care of, well maintained, and people that are paying $200,000 or $300,000 in a month don't live in filth, right?
Yes, that is definitely an advantage of the nicer properties. We do get a lot of filth. Yeah, I mean, the two main kinds of filth. Either we get that a lot with foreign students that have kind of bunked in two or three or four of them to an apartment, and they tend to be young and dirty, just especially if it's the guy. No, actually, not only the guys, very much the girls as well. Or old destitute men who just sit in the apartment and smoke all day, never turn on the fans, never open the windows. And then when they move out or pass away, whatever the case may be, it's pretty horrid in there.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like, again, in Tokyo...
But those are not tenants that you would have, would it? Would you?
Like, no, like the cheaper rents we have, like, will be like 60 to 80,000 yen a month.
Yeah.
And that's it. But more of them are like 250 to, you know, we got one now that we're, you know, the most recent guy that just signed up for his place is like 420,000 yen a month. And someone who's paying 420,000 yen a month is not a destitute old person.
No, not going to be the case.
Right. They're a professional, either dual, a couple with like professional, like power couple, or just one person is very quite successful if they're paying that. So I just don't feel that's actually one of the good things in Japan, which I think even some of your clientele in the more regional cheaper areas, relatively speaking to the cheaper equivalents in Australia, a Japanese tenant in these cheap areas is not going to be as messy or as cumbersome as or as high risk. They're not going to leave
the equivalent in Australia, or let's not even go to the US where people get shot trying to collect the rent in the wrong neighborhood or whatnot. Very true.
I think there's a difference there, but that's why I like investing in Japan. I think it's a safe, stable investment. Even if you go in different regions, even if you choose the lower price point versus the higher price point, you're going to get overall just an ordinary, mild-mannered Japanese tenant for the most part.
Yes.
And it's low headache, low drama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Low involvement.
And far, far less payment issues.
Yeah. Especially now, the guarantee company is just a standard.
Yeah.
With any process. So it's like, well, even if they default, but just that doesn't, it's not so common, I feel. It's a small amount.
Yeah, we get, I'd say about 1 or 2, 2.5% of our tenants at most ever have payment issues. It's very rare.
Yeah, it's just
And not... even then, I mean, you ask them to move out and they move out. That's how it ends if it has to go that way.
Yeah. Fortunately, we haven't had that drama.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you for your time today, sir.
You too, Ziv.
Anything exciting planned for the coming week?
Busy for me because I'm going back to Australia in 2 weeks, middle of September. To see the kids on the spring holiday, Australian spring holiday. So I'm quite busy right now with lots of viewing, lots of ramping up stuff before then. So
a belated Obon.
Yes. All the catch-up time.
Awesome. I'll be in Singapore next week, so I'll see you the week after that.
Nice. Okay, enjoy your travels.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks for your time. Speak to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, yeah, really casual, but strangely enough, quite deep conversation with Emil there. I love having these chats with him and all members of our JREP crew. They always have some insights to share or different takes on the same topics that I can learn from, and this conversation was no different. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com.
and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku!